Hello, Tomorrow Built Today listeners. This is one of your co-hosts, Jana Mesher-Smith. For those of you new to the podcast, we cover investing trends and predictions along with discussions about the latest news in tech. This week, we are bringing you several talks from Lightspeed's Enterprise Scale Summit that took place recently in San Francisco. You'll hear firsthand from industry icons in the enterprise with their tips for successfully scaling a company. One note to keep in mind is that because we recorded this live, which included a lot of hand gestures and animation from the speakers, the voice quality isn't perfect, but the content more than makes up for it. Please sit back, enjoy, and be ready to take notes. In this episode, you'll hear a conversation between Jay Simons, president of Atlassian, and Arif Jun Mohammed, partner at Lightspeed.
So before we jump in to interviewing Jay, I just wanted to give a little bit of context on Jay. Jay's someone I've known for over a decade. He's a friend. He's one of those people in the industry who always has something to share and something to some wisdom to impart. 20 years in the industry. Most recently, he spent the last decade at Atlassian. Atlassian's an incredible company. It's one of those outlier companies that really has defined an industry and that a lot of us look up to from the perspective of both product and go-to-market motion. Atlassian's worth $30 billion in the public markets, depending on the day that you look at your stock ticker. It employs over 4,000 people around the globe. It's a distributed company. And it broke the billion-dollar mark this year at posting $1.2 billion in revenue. Not ARR, revenue. So let's welcome Jay up on the stage to share some of the wisdom. Come on up, Jay. All right, Jay. No pressure.
All right. Thanks for the intro.
Well, there might be people here that don't know what Atlassian does and who it is. So tell us a little bit about Atlassian, what they do, what you guys sell.
Who doesn't know who Atlassian is? We make software for teams. So our more popular products include Jira, Confluence, Trello, Bitbucket.
What are those products?
Jira is a collaborative issue and project tracking system. Confluence is a collaborative content creation sharing system. Trello, probably a lot of you know, is a kind of a simple, lightweight tool for planning, brainstorming, a bunch of different things that you can do with teams. Bitbucket is a code collaboration product. The company's mission is to unleash the potential of teams. You know, we believe while teams might not be the catalyst for a single idea, any source of genius can't be delivered without the hard work of people trying to accomplish something together, and that's what we work in pursuit of.
Awesome. So before we dive into Atlassian and some of the magic there, tell us a little bit about yourself. One of the things that's always amazed me is I think you've had two, maybe three jobs in your career. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. I came down to San Francisco in 97. From Seattle. I grew up in a little town south of Seattle, went to school at University of Washington, and joined a little company called Plumtree Software, which was also in the collaboration market, the portal software market in the early 90s. I went public in 2002, kind of sputtered through the dot-com crash like most companies, and then got acquired in 04 by BEA Systems. And BEA got acquired by Oracle, and I no offense to any Oracle people, I didn't want to work for Oracle. So I kind of jumped ship and went to Atlassian. It may be a funny story, you know, like I guess I came from a family that that my mom ingrained this philosophy around not quitting. And sort of like the story I'll tell is, you know, I've played piano since I was four. So I wanted to play piano. I don't remember actually volunteering for that, but apparently I did. And then like any kid, I tried to quit multiple times and was told you can't quit. Like you have to study, you have to play piano until you graduate high school. Eventually, I think my mom kind of relented and said, well, if you want to quit, you're going to have to go tell your teacher that you want to quit. And this is like this, you know, wonderful woman that I'd studied piano with every week for years and years. And so I drummed up the courage and I went in and I said, you know, I started to cry and, you know, I'm like, it's not you, it's me. And, and you know, I'm sorry, I want to quit. And then I ran out to the car and, you know, my mom followed me out and she opened the car door and she said, get your ass back in there, you're not quitting. And so, like, you know, maybe I've always lived in fear that if I quit a company, my mom's going to be outside and say, get your ass back in there. But, you know, like, I mean, in truth, I've been blessed to have, really great opportunities, like a lot of ice that you can continue to break with really great people that you get to work for and lots of challenges, and I've never been bored.
Awesome. And what was your role at Plumtree and BA? And then
I started in inside sales and kind of grew up through the sales organization and you know, moved to Europe and kickstarted Europe before, you know, it was like always in front of a a little product that that I think drew a lot of inspiration from Plumtree called SharePoint. And was always sort of carving the market a little bit in front of Microsoft until that became really difficult for Plumtree. But kind of grew up through the sales organization and then kind of jumped from the sales organization in Asia Pacific into product marketing, which is a logical connection point for at least in really traditional enterprise software businesses that Plumtree was, and then spent kind of the back part of my career in marketing. Awesome. And then joined Atlassian to run sales and marketing, like go-to-market, basically.
How did you even find Atlassian, or how did they find you?
So we had, Plumtree had gone public in 2002, kind of sputtered along for 2 years, and you know, we were a collaboration software company. This is kind of a funny story, too, and we plucked the smartest people inside of Plumtree from whatever project they were working on, and we said, listen, no pressure, but we need to kind of reinvent our product strategy, because just, you know, adding features in front of Microsoft, adding features to SharePoint probably isn't a good strategy, so we need to reinvent ourselves. And so put that team in kind of their own little room. They called themselves IDEO, which I think was really hip in 2004, and, you know, said, all right, we'll leave you alone, like, you know, make it happen. And I went to check on that team. At the time I was running, you know, marketing and kind of focus on market strategy, and went to check out that team, you know, a month in. I said, all right, guys, like, what have you worked on? And they said, well, you know, we've got a bunch of ideas, nothing really solid yet, but check out this product that we're using to kind of riff on stuff together. And they gave me a demo of a product called Confluence they're all using. And I'm like, man, you have to appreciate how thick the irony is that, you know, you guys are tasked with building better collaboration software using some other collaboration software. And so I went and did a little research on the company. It was this little Australian company that had started in 2002 that, you know, that had it ridiculously cheap software that our really smart engineers and product people loved. And I ran to the CEO of Plumtree and I just said, we should, you know, figure out how to buy this company. And at the time, like, managed to track one of the founders down on his phone and had this fascinating conversation where he just answered every question that I asked. And at one point, this is Mike,
yeah,
who's still co-founder, co-CEO, and said, at one point said, you know, mate, it sounds like you're trying to figure out if you can buy us. Sorry, I do terrible Australian accent. Like, even after 12 years, I can't get it right. I can only say g'day. But, you know,
that's not a knife.
Yeah, I can say that one too. But anyway, he said, you know, it sounds like you're trying to figure out if you can buy us. I'm like, we're not for sale. But even if we would sell, you know, it wouldn't be less than 30 mil. And, you know, they had just done a million. And so I was like, that's kind of crazy. And they were crazy in all the right ways. But anyway, sort of, you know, didn't really pay attention to them for a couple of years. And then when I decided to leave Oracle through that acquisition, an analyst at Gartner that I'd spent a lot of time with over the years knew I was going to leave and said, I love this little company called Atlassian. Have you ever heard of them? And they were looking for someone to run marketing and sales.
Awesome. So you joined in 2008. What was the state of the company back then?
I'd just done about 20 million in revenue, about 100 people. Mostly, most of the people were still in Australia. We had a small little, you know, band of Spartans in San Francisco. And, you know, go-to-market was, you know, based here, was going to be based here, and we sort of grew and expanded.
You know, one product, two products?
Two products. You know, yeah. The first product was Jira, which Atlassian shipped in 2002. And I think that first year did $18,000 in revenue in 2002. And, you know, quickly on the heels of Jira, which is a really unconventional choice, built and shipped a second product called Confluence. And you know, those are still very meaningful products, like in our portfolio and in the business. When I joined, they were kind of the bulk of the business.
Yeah. So you're approaching $1.5 billion in revenues, is what we talked about. Ended your fiscal year July 1.2, still growing close to 40% at this scale, which is unbelievable. And you've got a pretty unique business model. Tell us a little bit about that.
So some of you may have heard before, but I guess like the, you know, the Reader's Digest version. I don't know, like, what's the modern equivalent of Reader's Digest now? I don't know. Anyway, the crib notes. All right, yeah, the TLDR. That's perfect. you know, we started just after, you know, this global technology meltdown. And so, you know, our founders who wanted to build collaboration software for technical people initially. Probably couldn't raise funding if they wanted to. And they chose to kind of attack the market by just democratizing access to the product. And this was sort of the formative period of the internet where you could actually distribute things to the world a little bit more easily than kind of landing a bunch of people in different places around the planet. And so, you know, they chose to price, you know, largely Jira was competing with open source, which was free. And so they chose to price the product a little bit more expensive than free. It was like the first version of Jira was $800. It's all that you could spend on Jira. Fast forward today, there's a version of Jira that, you know, that we sell for $500,000 a year. But back then, that was like their approach. And, you know, they believed, which we've proven, you know, that they believed that you could reach anyone anywhere. And if you just worked on removing friction from the customer's path, for the most part, that's what customers want. They just sort of want to get to, you know, the solution for their problem. If you make it simple enough for them to understand, simple enough for them to try and prove, simple enough for them to buy, they will. And, you know, we've told this story, maybe some of you have heard it, but, you know, the early days, it's like everything was hand-to-hand combat, right? And so there's a group of them in Australia, all engineers. They had a fax machine at the time. If you don't know what a fax machine is, ask me later. But they had a fax machine at the time. And you know, every customer they'd kind of work with, and then, you know, they'd convince a customer to buy, and they'd say, well, okay, how do I buy this? And you fill out this paper I'm going to send to you, and then you fax it into us. So the fax machine would buzz, and, you know, somebody would walk over and pick it up and say, hey, who was working with company, whatever the company's name was, and an engineer would raise their hand. And every time they'd figured out, well, what did we have to do to get this transaction concluded? And, you know, there were some early obvious things. It's like, well, they'd ask us how much the product cost. Oh, shit, we should just, like, publish the price on the web. They wanted to try it. Oh, crap, we should make a demo available. You know, they wanted to know, you know, what our support policies were. Ah, it's a good thing to actually die. So all these things they were kind of building over time. And they believed that just the funnel was a product, just like any other thing, and that a customer that needed help, that was sort of a bug, it was kind of a defect that they could fix for future customers along the way. And one day, the fax machine was like customer number 11. I think it was American Airlines. It buzzed, paper comes across the fax, somebody picks it up and says, you know, who's working with American Airlines? And no one raised their hand. And, you know, they couldn't believe it. So, you know, being engineers, they, like, went and did, like, you know, analyzed the web logs and were trying to figure out how the heck American Airlines had gone all the way through the funnel and had just decided to, like, send in a check for $3,600. Hmm. So fast forward today, you know, we have largely scaled that model. And, you know, so a vast majority, almost like the entirety of customers that we land, you know, we've removed all the friction from their path. They can understand, you know, how much the product costs. They can try it without, you know, needing us to interfere with them. We're there to kind of smother them with love and help if they need it. And that creates a really vital land point from which we can expand up to now, you know, the Fortune 10 that are going to spend millions and millions of dollars a year.
How many customers do you have?
150,000.
How many organizations?
150,000 organizations.
Oh, wow.
So we probably have more customers than we do have more customers than that. We define a paying customer as a customer that spends more than $10 a month, mm-hmm. and they are a unique entity. And so Ford is, you know, one of those 150,000, even though there could be a gajillion different versions of Ford, the Ford domain that use various Atlassian products.
Yeah, and average sales price?
It's like probably on the whole, it's still sub 10K.
Sub 10K.
Yeah, but there's a big range there, right? Because you can start, you know, our philosophy is that it's, and this is kind of a benefit to the model, that we can start small, and there's a ton of opportunity. But, you know, even in a company like, you know, pick Exxon, we're happy to start with a team of 10. And that team of 10, we know now with 17 years of kind of road in the rearview mirror that we know what that road looks like. We know that team of 10, the natural network effects of collaboration software and the virality of what we do and a bunch of things that we do both in product, in market, with customer success, enables that 10 to beget another 10, to beget another 100, to beget another 1,000. And we actually don't have to do a lot of work. And so, you know, part of the reason the model, you know, was built the way it was is because the economics didn't really support an alternative. You know, you couldn't hire, you know, a forward deployed sales organization to work really hard to get a $2,500 transaction. But those $2,500 transactions, you know, continue to grow even today. And that's sort of the bulk of how the business starts. And so, you know, we'll have much larger transaction sizes, but they tend to be existing customers where we've already proven the value of the software. And the heavy lifting of convincing the customer that they should use a lot more of our software has already been done.
So do you have any salespeople?
We do.
What do they do?
Yeah, we do.
And how many? And
We do. So we have probably a total of about 50 in a business of 400. And, you know, we started kind of the first sales team that we added in the business. So we have a group of people that we call advocates. Like, they're advocates on behalf of the product and the customer. And they work pre-sale in a largely customer success capacity to basically continue to remove friction. Like, if you're going to have customers that need help, and we let them know you can opt in to, like, be smothered with a bunch of attention and love. Otherwise, we'll leave you alone. We're not going to really try, because we know the rest of the model that we continue to improve incrementally is going to get the majority of customers there. And we sort of deferred, you know, we'd sold into the enterprise basically since day one, like American Airlines was customer number 11, but they were always sort of small. And we kind of deferred for a long time a bunch of energy and investment into our enterprise product. And until, like, we really needed to, there was a big enough cohort of large companies that needed us to do specific things for them. And we chose to build all those things and then create a new offering for those customers and new ones that were going to come that was materially more expensive. It was, like, in some cases, an order of magnitude more expensive than the products that they were already using. We're quite sure that we had product market fit. So we took that group of product advocates and we said, hey, you are going to reach out to these customers that we know have these needs, and you're going to talk to them about how the $20,000 version of Jira they're using probably isn't fit for purpose, and there's a $200,000 version of Jira that we want them to upgrade to. So that was our first sales team, and, you know, it was a group of about five of them. And we found that we did have we could convince customers to take that kind of upgrade leap. And you know, what we did then was, like, we already have this flywheel that kind of spins and an automated self-service model and kind of, you know, an e-commerce delivery mechanism for transacting with customers. We put that product on the web. If you look at where it's priced on the web, we spent a bunch of time on pricing, which you'll probably ask me about. But, you know, so the price point of that premium version kind of intersects with the standard version. But, the price curve actually goes up a lot steeper. And so it's the same price at 500 users, and that's where we want to get customers on, and then you ramp materially faster as you add users. So to answer the original question, the sales team today largely focuses on expansion and upsell for a particular set of products into the enterprise that have high enough ACVs for it to be worthwhile. And then the other really important point that we haven't mentioned is along the, you know, the for the past 12 years since I joined, you know, we began to develop in 2008 a channel. And, you know, we the channel, you know, like it is for Microsoft, is a really important ingredient in our business model, because we focus on building this high velocity self-service flywheel. We do that really well. We know how to do it. And there's a lot of cases where customers need more attention and energy, and an indirect solution reseller and solution partner was the perfect ingredient, because they could invest more in the selling that might need to be done at the enterprise segment that we didn't want to do, and so we could partner for that. And in most of those cases, there was some service delivery and customization and consulting that would be accompanied with that. So it was a perfect match. They're all in the business of what's on the other side of the transaction, not just the margin they take for reselling. But we have today 500 partners that represent us all around the world. Tend to, you know, over-index in non-English-speaking geographies, and then tend to over-index in, you know, really large enterprise opportunities. But we are an incredibly channel-friendly business, because, you know, we've got some symbiosis with them.
Right, right. So we talked sales. Tell us a little bit about your marketing strategy, how it's different from, you know, the traditional enterprise marketing strategy, and how it's unique to Atlassian, and any takeaways that people here can learn from.
I think there's a lot of things that we do that are common. You know, maybe I think we had to build the discipline early on around marketing driving the ball all the way into the end zone. And so, you know, we didn't have kind of a traditional handoff to a sales organization where we were generating a lead for someone else to close. Like, the lead was basically generated for the product to close. And so, you know, we made probably earlier investments than a lot of companies would in, you know, deeply quantitative you know, deeply quantitative marketing skill set, and kind of a better understanding around metrics and, you know, data and experimentation and, you know, growth in product and kind of a bunch of infrastructure that you have to build to kind of make all that happen. And that's maybe the biggest difference. I think that we, you know, still today and even back then, I think, you know, as a marketing organization, we do all the things that probably all of your marketing organizations do. We spend a lot of money, like the time in O2, when some channels in marketing kind of open and before they get saturated, you have an opportunity to take advantage of them. We took a deep advantage of SEM in O2 as it kind of exploded, and that's still a really important channel for us today to own. But you know, we spend on brand advertising and event marketing, and you know, we have a channel marketing program that's pretty mature. We focus on, you know, activating markets for the channel and making sure that they can get connected into opportunities. And with a sales organization, we do all the things that probably you do around generating qualified opportunities that we think are rich enough for sales team to be deployed into.
Awesome. And I'm going to get this wrong, but you don't touch 99% of your customers. Talk to us about cross-sell, upsell, customer success, right? So a lot of the magic is around the expansion of these customers, right? So if you're not talking to them, how do you do it?
So we talk to a lot more than 1% of customers.
Yeah.
And, we tend to over-index the attention that we'll give to a customer, maybe not surprisingly, on companies that have the most value. And so, you know, the enterprise segment for us is going to get, more touch and more outreach than smaller companies. But we do, like I said earlier, you know, we invite any customer, to engage with us. And we want to make sure if they've got issues that we can help resolve them.
What does engagement mean for a customer with you?
It can be, you know, they're gonna raise their hand. And so the product advocate team basically is a group that a customer will say, I've got a problem, I've got a question, I've got an issue that isn't kind of a deep tech, you know, product bug fix. I need help. Like, I want something. And, you know, in the cloud, we can see some of that telemetry in the product where we can actually forward deploy some of those people proactively. But you know, a customer can say, like, I just need somebody to talk to answer my question. And that particular team is measured on volume and CSAT. And so, like, that's maybe a little atypical from a lot of models. Is like, we know the flywheel works to convert. We know the product will convert. And so, you know, we don't have a group of you know, pre-sales customer success people that are focused on converting and building a one-to-one relationship because, you know, we've got massive volume. You know, we add thousands and thousands of new customers a month. And and so that volume means that we have to think differently about human engagement. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of work that goes into making sure that we're continually improving the product and, you know, aspects of the marketing funnel to engage, and that we're really thoughtful about segmentation. That we're really thoughtful about where customers need more attention than maybe we're instrumented to give them. We can introduce them to a channel partner. It's a whole bunch of different channels for customer success and growth. And, right. You know, the last thing I would say is there's opportunities, like I mentioned, with, you know, the sales team that are valuable and rich enough and important enough and maybe complicated enough for us to invest a lot more energy in building a relationship with a customer that is one-to-one and understanding what their needs are. But, you know, I believe, you know, we believe that, you know, a lot of the larger kind of cross-sale opportunities are things that you could flow from within the product. And, you know, so maybe one of the handicaps of a traditional sales approach is typically you're selling one-to-one and you're trying to sell to an influencer, which is important. But if you've got a product that has 1,000 people using it, you've got 1,000 touch points to cross-flow. You've got 1,000 touch points to cross-sell. And they're all different permutations of what's going to trigger somebody to be activated into what you're trying to sell them. So I'll give you an example. Like, you know, if you're familiar with Jira and Confluence, like Confluence is used to create content, Jira is used to manage projects. Oftentimes, like, you are linking those two things together. And so if we see a Jira customer that's copying, you know, pasting Google Docs links or attaching... sorry to keep pointing to you in Microsoft, but, you know, attaching Office documents or Office 365 links, it's a good opportunity for us, anytime anyone does that, to say, hey, actually, can we show you maybe a more delightful way. It looks like you're connecting content to this project. Can we show you a more delightful way to do that? And I don't have to like go to somebody in IT or the sponsor. I can do that for 1,000 people whenever I see any of them do that behavior. And that becomes a trigger point to cross-sell. Mm-hmm. And so I think we just have a lot more leverage in cross-selling from within the product than we would only kind of hand-to-hand combat.
And you've also been really thoughtful about pricing. You alluded to this earlier, but yeah. It has to do with cross-selling and product bundles. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think like most people, we kind of stumbled into a pricing strategy. It's like in retrospect, it looks genius. But you know, I think it was all, you know, it was all just like finger in the air and you know, hope and a prayer. But I mentioned like it kind of began with where we started, which is the first version of our product was priced at $800. And actually, take a step back. I think it really, our pricing starts from a position of believing that we should be able to sell our product to every company on the planet. It's what we believe. It's our ambition. Doesn't matter how small, doesn't matter how big. Like, we want to sell you something. And so if you start there, you have to have a pricing plan that can support that. So ours was, and our other philosophy is simplicity. And so like part of removing friction is, you know, we don't want a bunch of cognitive load on the customer when they're trying to figure out what we do, because we didn't want to invest in early on in addressing that cognitive load, which often salespeople need to do. I can't understand the options. I don't know what I'm buying here. Like, I can't figure it out, so somebody has to explain it to me. And so we had a single flat price, $800. And we kind of held that line for a long time. And what that meant was, you know, sort of the Johnny Appleseed strategy. We were just like planting seeds all over, everywhere. It was so easy to buy Atlassian, and, you know, it was so cheap that it was just kind of a non-brainer or no-brainer. And when we started to increase the price, you know, we did it by just adding tiers. And so we said, well, it's 800 flat, kind of unlimited number of users. And then, you know, it was like, well, actually, you know, the $800 version is now only 1,000 users, and there's going to be a $4,000 version that's 1,000 users plus. And so customers, like, you actually have to say now how many users you have. And if you have more than or under 1,000 users, you stay where you are. If you have more, there's a price increase. But come on, like, you know, it's for 4,000 users, it's still really affordable. And that's sort of been the strategy over time, you know, where we created a lot of future opportunity for us to get smarter about adding additional value. And usually we're doing kind of a price increase. We're adding, like I said, in the enterprise strategy, we're adding a bunch of things that we know that particular customer cohort needs, that they're willing to see a price increase or pay more money for. And we're really thoughtful about pricing. It's a really important mechanic in the business, in any company's business model. But you know, the ingredients were simplicity. If you think about it, you know, a lot of SaaS companies start with free, standard, premium, enterprise. The enterprise one has, I'm not going to tell you how much it costs, you have to ask me.
Yeah.
And we, you know, if you look at our products now, we have that. But, you know, we, in our cloud is like over 10 years old. Up until, you know, a handful of months ago, we had one, you know, basically one price for each product. It was price per user. So you paid on the number of users. There was no additions. And so we're a, you know, more than a 10-year-old cloud business that just added additions. And you know, you could say, like, maybe you should have added them 10 years ago. But I think the benefit to us was the simplicity allowed us to build a really incredible cloud business without any of the cognitive load that I mentioned. Now we have 100,000 companies that we can sell additions to. And that's easier than trying to win 100,000 companies with a whole bunch of additions. And so it's a really different strategy and approach, but it's worked for us. It's working for us.
Yeah, $1.2 billion in revenue is growing close to 40% year over year. You once told me that at the beginning of the quarter, you know exactly where you're going to end at the end of the quarter. Walk us through a little bit of that machine.
It's sort of like, and you know, I am a salesperson. I mean, I started my career in sales, so this is there's nothing against salespeople, because I am one, and they're a really important part of building any business. But you know, our business is what a business looks like without a lot of human mechanic in it. And the human mechanic in sales organizations, you're probably familiar with, it's, you know, I've got some variable discounting I can do. You know, we've just trained the market, you know, we've trained all the bad behavior. It's our fault. And so I've got a bunch of variable discounting, and the customer knows that, and they actually know I'm under pressure. I've got a number on my head. I really care about that because, you know, that goes to my pocketbook. And so potentially I care more about my pocketbook than I do about the long-term durability of the company that I work for. There's sort of a bunch of things that aren't always great. And what happens in a lot of companies is at the end of the quarter, you know, you do a third of your business in the first 2 months and then two-thirds of your business in the last month because of all of that gibberish. And the really bad part about that gibberish is when you get desperate, you're like, man, I really need to hit this number and I can get a little more, I can go over the line into the quarter in front of me and I can get a little more aggressive with the fish that are swimming in that pool just to make it work, and I'll kick the can and figure out how to solve next quarter's problem next quarter. And that, I mean, eventually that catches up to you. And in our business, we don't have that. You know, there's a couple other really interesting properties of the business. You know, when we went public in 2015, we had 50,000 customers. We had one modified license agreement. So we had one customer that we had agreed to different terms, and it was Goldman Sachs. And it was because a customer service rep signed the agreement without telling us, and sent it back. And no offense to Goldman Sachs, but they made us honor that. They're like, you signed it, and so that. And they actually, they were the bank that took us public. But but that's so another property of how it works. But the chart that you're mentioning is, you know, when you look at the when you look at the linearity of sales through a quarter for us, so bookings, sales, not revenue, because revenue is going to be linear, it's a straight line. And so what that means is if at the beginning of the quarter, you know, we're targeting $10 million, we think we're going to do $10 million, it's a straight line up to 10. It's, you know, it's not like, you know, 2 in the first 2 months and then 8 in the last month. It's straight. And what that means for our business and what it's meant for our business is predictability. It's meant durability. We're not like mortgaging our future just to sort of make ends meet in a given quarter. And it means that even now, like, you know, we're a public company. Is it being recorded? There's not a lot I can do in the quarter. Like, there's not a lot we can do to change the outcome of the quarter, nor would we, right? And it means that leadership in our business is not thinking about the quarter. We're thinking about the quarter a year from now. And we're thinking about the quarter 2 years from now. And that is a liberating thing to have. Yeah. And it's the one thing, you know, it is, you know, one of many things in our model that we've been really protective of. We're not dogmatic about the model. I think we want to make sure that we go where growth is, but we want to be thoughtful about, you know, how we build for that growth, because there's some things that are really virtuous in the business that I think are, you know, we want to make sure that we continue investing and keep.
You've also been very thoughtful and potentially unconventional relative to Silicon Valley in terms of growth. You mentioned growth. I think it's been 35% compounding growth over 17 years. Is that right?
Pretty close. Yeah, we never really did the triple-triple-double-double-double thing. I mean, we've always been in these band, in kind of the growth band, almost back to the very beginning, you know, between 30 and 50%. And, you know, we inflected back up, you know, we hit sort of sub 30 in 09, like a lot of companies did. And so the global financial crisis kind of dinged us, but we rebounded. We, you know, kicked in different gears kind of, you know, later in our life that inflected growth, you know, from high 30s up to high 40s. But, you know, we always looked at another company that we admired that, at least until, AWS kicked in, you know, Amazon had a really similar profile. It was like 15 years of somewhere between 30 and 50%. And, you know, that CAGR is pretty nice.
What's a mistake that you can share? Mistake you guys made over the last decade that you can share? That wasn't in our script over here, but I thought I'd throw it out there.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you two. Well, I'll give you two. I'll give you one. One is you know, like a lot of companies, I think we didn't take security seriously enough. And so, you know, we had, you know, got hacked, had a hacking incident a long time ago that, you know, fortunately didn't inflict a mortal wound. but it could have easily. And so I'm sure everybody's heard that message, but it should be a first principle of the business, especially where you've got data that your customers are trusting you to protect and keep. And it always feels like something you'll get to, and you've got the MVP. But we learned a really hard lesson around it's not just MVP, it's actually got to be super freaking bulletproof, and we have to be in front of all the people that are going to try to outwit us. Mm-hmm. That was a painful lesson. The other one, which is maybe less painful, but it was a good one, is we've been a globally distributed company, and we wanted to open a lower cost development center. And we did, a big project to, look at different sites, and selected Vietnam. And we selected Vietnam because they have a really strong kind of math and sciences education. It was, a kind of a developing part for technology. Felt like we could get great talent there. And so we went in there, started an office, ramped it up to about, 150 people. We have a hackathon, quarterly hackathon called Ship It. And, for the first year and a half, they won every single one. They were just incredible. But the thing that we didn't anticipate as a young company, you'd be like, oh, should have, was we couldn't find leaders that had scale experience. And so it was fine until we got to about 150 people. And then nobody knew how to manage bigger teams. And nobody really wanted to move to Saigon that did. And so we were like, oh, that's a mistake. And we had to wind that office down, which was painful. We managed to take about half of them, import half of them into Australia, but there was half of them that we couldn't or didn't want to leave their country. And that was a painful lesson where that's we basically had to shut an office down.
Yeah. So final question.
Yeah.
You use the word scale. That actually is the topic du jour. That's why we're all here, to talk scale. And we'll ask this question of everybody today. So everybody else who's talking, be ready for this one. But what is the single most? And maybe it's really hard to pick out one, but if you did have to pick out one factor, one thing that you guys did successfully to scale your organization or the company, what would it be?
I'm gonna avoid the culture one, because I think is what everyone would expect me to say, and it is important. Let me give two quick ones. One is I think we work really hard on systems, and systems can feel like big company things, God, process. We just want to go where we go and figure it out as we figure it out. And I think we've been a company that has tried to kind of build systems because they're important. Systems are important for scale, and even down to simple things like early on, we built a system for making decisions. How do decisions get made? How do they get documented? What are the frameworks that we can use to simplify the process of making a decision, understanding who makes the decision, documenting that it was made, informing the people that need to know? And that can feel a little heavyweight, but if you, back to culture, if you've got that system and people, when you join, they're like, oh shit, that's kind of nice. I understand how decisions are made here, and I understand who makes them. And by the way, I also have a catalog of where the decisions were all made. That was, that was one. And then I think the other thing is we're always working on urgency and speed. And still today, the biggest thing as you get big, it's the whack-a-mole that you just want to continue to pound down is how do we make sure that we're fast and we're really urgent. And it's the penguins that kind of all congregate at the edge of the ice and then there's one that just slings himself into herself into the water. We want to be that penguin. Although shit, that's probably the first one that gets eaten. That's that's a bad example, but that's what we're trying to work on. And I think we recognize that we're not going to be the same company at 4,000 people that we were at 400, but we want to be the most urgent and fastest company of 4,000 people around. And we keep our eye on that.
That's awesome. Thank you, everyone. Please welcome.
Thanks.
Jay, this was great.
Thanks, man.
Thanks.
If you want to find out more about Jay, you can follow him on Twitter @JaySimons. Thanks again for listening to this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, please go to iTunes or wherever you're listening to and rate and review it. You can also find us at tbtpodcast.com. Tomorrow Built Today is produced by Lightspeed Venture Partners. The theme music you heard today is by Mikhail Manvalin.